Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The chance to interview another interviewer is an opportunity that I like to take. A chance came to me on September 4th, 2007, when I was able to visit with Ira Flatow, the host of Science Friday, a part of Talk of the Nation on NPR. He and I talked about some ideas and concepts he raises in his new book, Present at the Future, From Evolution to Nanotechnology, Candid and Controversial Conversations on Science and Nature. I think that after 35 years as a science journalist, Ira Flatow has seen enough to know unexpected changes are in order. He refers to that at the close of the introduction of his book and writes, "After watching science do its thing for a while, you realize knowledge is really a moving target. What we know today will probably be wrong tomorrow. And science is that tool for discovery. When science tells us something, chances are that it will tell us something different a few years from now." And that's where Ira Flatow and I began our conversation. Ira Flatow, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thank you very much. I love the name of your show.
Well, thank you. It answers questions about life and ideas, or at least some of the questions that I have.
Well, it's good to be curious. There's so much new, and there's so much interesting going around that I really can't understand how there are people who are not curious, how they can live their lives.
Well, that's what I wonder. And what I'm wondering now in conversation with you about present at the future, you comment that after watching science do its thing for a while, you've come to realize that knowledge is really a moving target. Can you explain that continuum as you have observed it over the years?
Well, what we know today to be true is just fleeting knowledge in many cases. You know, you can go back to something as simplistic as the Earth being flat, and then we know that it's not flat. Some more interesting, newer things would be like we have been told for generations that our minds, that our neurons, our nerve cells are basically rigid, and that if they get damaged or we have an accident, and that we can't replace them, and our brains are basically very rigid. Little boxes, but we are now really learning very interesting new things about the brain that tell us how plastic the brain is, that the brain is able to actually recover. There are parts of the brain that, if they are damaged, other parts of the brain can take over for them. We can repair cells. There are stem cells that will actually create new cells or repair the old cells, which we never, you know, we're always told that the cells you're born with as a baby, they're the cells you'll take with you to your grave. It doesn't seem to be true anymore.
What are some of the opportunities that you've observed that have indicated that the brain is plastic and it can learn new things that we once thought it couldn't?
Well, we find that when people who have strokes and they lose the functioning of parts of their bodies, if we teach them, we can teach a new part of the brain to take over the functioning. You can teach the new part of the brain, for example. I'll just give it an example off the top of my head, generic example. If your arm, you have a stroke in your arm and you can't use it and it's limp, or your leg, we can teach the part of the brain that controls that, different part, to take over those functions. We are just discovering things about the brain that we never thought before.
Is that done by instruction of muscle memory?
Yes. It's actually quite repetitive. You know, sort of force the brain. You force the brain to create new circuits.
Similar to how a baby learns to walk.
Yeah, I remember speaking to Oliver Sacks, famous neurologist. He was talking about music in the brain, and how there are, you know about savants who are great musicians, but they can't do anything else. I think he may be in the process of writing a book. He was when I was talking to him, but back about a year ago, where he has discovered a musician in England named Clive who has a seven-second memory. He cannot remember anything past 7 seconds ago. In fact, he's still in love with his wife when he knows who she is, but he can't remember who she is. Yet he still has this great musical ability. He can conduct a whole orchestra and play a very complex piece of music, sit down at the piano, and not even remember he had played it 7 seconds later. So the brain has so many mysterious parts and workings about it that we have no idea about, you know? It's just fascinating.
Your book pretty much focuses on the brain through your interpretation of other scientists talk. Well, I'm going to start that over. Your book seems to focus on the brain and its tentacles out into other parts of society that we've studied. What drew you to study the brain and science and become a science journalist back when you were 22 years old?
I was always curious about how the world works. I was one of these kids who blew things up in the basement. You know, in the days when chemistry sets could blow things up. They can't do that anymore.
I remember those.
But I was not interested in chemistry. In fact, chemistry is my worst subject. I have a mental block against chemistry to this day. But I was interested in electronics, and I used to create electronic devices. I would buy popular electronics magazine and build these little projects. I would go down to, before the World Trade Center is where it was, it used to be called Radio Row. It was a part of Manhattan down there in about 13, 14 blocks that on the streets of the city had big cardboard boxes full of old vacuum tubes and parts of radar scopes and World War II surplus items that you could buy for 5 cents a piece. And I would bring these home and make, you know, fun little devices in my basement, transformers. I once built as a science fair project a punch card reader. I'm sure you remember punch cards. I built a device that for the science fair that would teach you how to read, allow you to read punch cards. And so I was...
I think we better interrupt here for a minute. And for some of our listeners who don't know what punch cards are, can you describe them?
Well, they were a technology from the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And then there used to be keyboards on computers. The first computers had no keyboards. It's hard to imagine how you would input information. Well, instead, you used to take these cards that they were about 8 inches long and about 2 inches wide, sit down at the keyboard, and the keyboard would punch holes in the card, and you'd shove it into the computer, and the computer would be able to read the information on the card instead of through the keyboard. And I built a device that would show you how to read the alphabet and numbers on the punch card the way the computer would read it. So I was always interested in that. I used to take TVs apart and repair them. So I was always interested in building things and tearing them apart, and I was curious about how the world worked. I would be the one who would be sitting out in my backyard, and I still do this, and look up at the sky, the planets. It was a great view of Saturn a few weeks ago that was, you know, best view we'll have for 50 years. I don't understand why people don't want to know how things work. I have a quote in the book from Richard Feynman who basically talks about that. And he says, when I look at a flower and when you look at a flower, we see two different things. I can appreciate the beauty of the flower itself, but I can also appreciate nature's work in putting this flower together because I understand how that works, and you may not. So I actually see more about the beauty of the flower than you do. This is Feynman saying that. I mean, until I actually found that, I never, you know, I thought I was the only one who thought that way about things. That's how I look at the world. I want to know how it works.
Well, Ira Flatow, author of Present at the Future, From Evolution to Nanotechnology, Candid and Controversial Conversations on Science and Nature, let's talk about the brain, and let's talk about MRIs and magnetic resonance imaging that allows us to see the workings of the brain while a person is thinking. Can you describe how the MRI works?
Well, I'll tell you, I'll give you a theory about how all brain imaging works, and there are a lot of different scans. There are MRI, there are PET scans, which are used more now. And basically, it's very simple, and it's true for any part of your body. When your part of your body is active, blood flows to it more than it does when it's not. So that if muscles are working, you'll see a spot that blood is flowing to that muscle. If your brain is working, that part of the brain will have more blood flowing to it. So these scans are able to detect the differences in blood flow in certain parts of the brain. They sort of come out in different colors. They light up the screen, as scientists like to say. They can watch your brain light up as it, like a Christmas tree, blinking on and off in different parts of your brain as it processes information. So they can actually put, and since this doesn't hurt anybody, these scans don't hurt you, they'll put you in a scanner and they'll ask you questions while you're being scanned, show you pictures, and watch, play music for you, and watch which parts of your brain light up. And this is an incredible new tool that they've never had before to just study how the brain works, and it has allowed them to learn so much more than we knew before.
One of the areas that interests me is criminal investigation and the use of the MRI, specifically by showing a potential defendant in a criminal case photographs of the crime scene and watching the brain light up. Because as I understand it, if they are new images, the lighting in the brain where the blood flows would be different than if they're old images.
The problem with the brain is, when is the brain telling the truth or not? Because police, law enforcement officials, lawyers all know that the brain likes to make up facts. In other words, if you're an eyewitness to an event, what you really see may not be what the brain really sees. And later on, when you're asked to recall it, the brain may make up a fact that never happened, and you're absolutely sure it happened. And this is a well-known, the lawyers know this in court, that how unreliable eyewitnesses are. And, for example, to test this out, they would go to Disney World, and people leaving Disney World, they would ask, "Did you see Bugs Bunny?" And half the people said, "Yeah, I saw Bugs Bunny," and they could tell you exactly where they saw them. Where he saw Bugs Bunny, when in fact Bugs Bunny is not a Disney character and was never in the park. But they will recall having seen it. And sometimes if you're asked to recall something, you will create an event in your brain that you swear is real. And it could be, what you had for dinner the other night, or it could be a childhood memory. That's why a lot of our memories are not reliable, because sometimes we will create these memories, and the brain, when we scan them, will put them in the place that's almost as real as the real thing.
So you're indicating then that my example of showing the crime scene image to a potential defendant would not be appropriate?
No, but it would not be appropriate, but you know what else is about crime scenes and crimes? Is by scanning the brain, we can actually watch the brain lie.
How do we do that?
We can give people a question and watch the brain conflict with itself about whether to tell the truth or not by looking at the emotional parts of the brain, where emotions are. And scientists have been trying to nail down, the emotional parts as they light up. And you can see somebody trying to, decide whether they're going to lie about the answer or not. It's very interesting. And so some people are wondering, well, maybe, brain scans are better indicators of lie detectors than those old lie detectors are.
Yet lie detectors are not admissible evidence in court.
Nope. And people are looking into whether, can we actually detect when people lie by looking at brain scans or not. And as you can see, it would be a very controversial area. There are a lot of things about things that are admissible in court that have no science basis in science. And the one most controversial one is fingerprinting.
Tell us about that.
If fingerprinting were introduced today, it would have a hard time being admitted as evidence.
Why?
Because there have never been any tests to show that fingerprinting is valid. There have been no real scientific testing that fingerprints are valid means of identification. They may be. I'm not saying they aren't. But the science has never been done to prove it.
In terms of the print of my finger or your finger, once it's taken on an ink blot and impressed on paper, may not be an accurate representation?
Well, it may be an accurate representation, but it hasn't been shown that it's unique to you.
Okay.
That you're the only one with that fingerprint. Now, that may all be true, and we assume it is, but the science hasn't been done. In fact, fingerprint identification is really an art. And it's very controversial now, because you can take 10 different fingerprint, specialists and get all of them, I shouldn't say be that cavalier about it, but find that they will identify fingerprints different ways. And they're only talking very recently now about certifying fingerprint specialists who we trust to know how to identify fingerprints correctly.
Well, let's talk about that in a moment. But first, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Ira Flatow from his home in Connecticut. He's the host of National Public Radio's Science Friday. He's also the author of Present at the Future, From Evolution to Nanotechnology, Candid and Controversial Conversations on Science and Nature. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Ira, how would the fingerprint science be tested?
Well, you'd have to set up an experiment. You'd have to present evidence, and it's possible to do this, you know, to show that if you take X number of fingerprints, thousands, millions of them, that statistically no two are alike, and that they, and statistically with a certain degree of certainty, usually it's over 95% in science, that that no two fingerprints are alike.
But that won't necessarily pass muster according to the laws of evidence, at least here in California.
That's the point I'm making. I'm saying if fingerprints were introduced today, they may not be accepted in many places.
Yet the sequencing of the DNA is...
Yes, DNA is a much better indicator. It's a much more accurate indicator of... You know, DNA fingerprinting is much more accurate than regular fingerprinting because it's not as much a talent for the fingerprinters as it is a science of the DNA.
What I find interesting about the fingerprint compared to the DNA is that we can all look at our fingerprint and on our hands and get a sense of what it may look like if it's expanded onto a screen in a courtroom. But we can't look at our DNA sequencing. That is, we are told that after the blood is drawn or the cheek swab is taken, someone analyzes it and says, here, Ira, or here, Barry, this is what your DNA sequence looks like. So we're relying on that intermediary to interpret.
Well, you're relying on the intermediary of the fingerprint expert also. I guarantee you, if you put fingerprints up on a screen and tried to identify them, you couldn't do it either. I've investigated this. Fingerprint experts look for a certain number of points on a fingerprint. They choose, I think, a minimum of 6 or 8 points, and as many, you add more points on the print itself, you get a more accurate reading. And now they have computers that are made to scan these points. It's not as easy as it looks, considering how many billions of different fingerprints there are. And I bet if they put those fingerprints up on the screen, you would have as tough a time looking at those as you would comparing the DNA fingerprint. And I think you could probably look at a DNA fingerprint, which got those little black bars on them, and let's see it for yourself how they match up.
Well, let's move along to science versus religion. You have an interesting section in your book on that topic.
Yes. Science and religion is a very old topic. And there's some scientists are very rabid about defending science versus religion. You have the Steven Weinbergs, the Dawkins, these people who have no problem with calling names of other people who dare to believe in God and be scientists at the same time, or who believe or are very upset that people even talk about religion. And then you have other people who have no problem with religion and they deal with religion in their everyday lives, and they're able to put religion in sort of into a box.
Can you share with us the story about James Watson when he was asked about religion?
Yeah, I was interesting. I was one of the very shocking moments of my career, and I was at the Tribeca Film Festival, moderating a panel James Watson was a panelist. A movie producer and director was there who had created a film about James Watson many years ago, and Watson was commenting, because it was Tribeca and a film festival, was commenting on the film versus real life. And then toward the end of the session, the Q&A session, a woman got up out of the audience, and we opened the floor to questions, and she got up and said to James Watson, I'm just delighted to be here, and she complimented him on all his work, and then asked him what motivated him in his research, Was there some, did he have some spiritual or religious motivation? And he just exploded. I mean, I've never seen anybody just go tear into this little old lady, basically, in the audience. And he said, "You don't understand." And he used words a lot stronger than I'm using, the curse words and the four-letter words. He said, "You don't understand the reason I was so eager to uncover the structure of the DNA molecule is because I wanted to take God out of the equation. We don't need to have God to explain how life works." And he just lambasted it into this woman, and she turned around and went back meekly to her seat. And in the next, over the next period of the next few months, I had more opportunities to interview him in public places. And it basically turned into the same thing. You know, I knew what button to push.
And you came to the conclusion that Watson is a showman and this is his act.
I think this was part, yeah. He was so able to turn, you know, turn things on that I was convinced that he enjoyed the confrontation.
What was behind this for Watson that he wanted to make this part of his act and create the confrontation?
I don't know. I can't get into his mind, but I'll tell you, there were cases. There was another case where there was a woman who actually worked in a laboratory, and he used her images to verify that he had created the exact DNA that he said he had, she died before the Nobel Prize came out, and you can't get a Nobel Prize if you're dead. She died at a young age because she was using X-rays, radiation, to actually make these films. And in those days, in the early 30s, people didn't know about safety as much as they do now. He never gives her credit. There have been books written about giving her credit for helping him make the discovery, and he never gives her credit. And he actually told me off camera once that she actually was a hindrance. He's the only one I've ever heard say this, and I've interviewed, you know, and I've read a lot about all the players. He's the only one who's ever said, and he said to me off mic, she was actually more of a hindrance than she was a help. We would have gotten there faster without her.
Let's talk about sleep and the sorting process that it gives us when we wake up in the morning and feel better.
What was interesting about sleep was some research by a gentleman named Stickgold at Harvard University. And he found that if you want to gain a new skill, if you want to learn how to play the piano, if you want to learn how to be better on a video game, a new skill, if you don't get 7 hours of sleep every night or while you're practicing the skill, it never cements itself. It's harder and harder. It takes you a much longer time to get the skill down. And I said to him, I never get 7 hours of sleep. You know, I'm in my 50s. I haven't had 7 hours of sleep in years. He said, bingo. Now you know why it's hard for older people to learn a new skill. He said, it's the sleep, it's the consolidation time, and we don't know why or what it is. But if you want to learn something new, a new skill, a new talent, something new, you better get that sleep. And that just lit up a light in my brain, you know. That explained a lot, and he was able to show this and reproduce this many times in his experiments.
Well, Ira Flatow, author of Present at the Future and host of Science Friday, in the 35 years that you've been watching the continuum of the development of science, using that as a foundation, where do you expect that there will be new changes in our scientific understanding?
Well, I think that there are going to be new changes in, as I say, in brain chemistry and understanding what's going on in the brain, how we think. There are going to be changes in cosmology. To me, the most fascinating areas of research now is just where we came from and where we're going. I mean, there's new information now that shows us that we haven't got the slightest idea of what the universe is made out of. I mean, imagine that. I mean, there 96% of the universe, we don't know what it is. It's all this dark, matter, and it's
far away.
It's far away, and 70% of it is dark energy that's started some 5 billion years ago and just started pushing the world apart.
So that takes us to the conflict of, do we study the Earth and the oceans, or do we begin to leave our atmosphere?
Well, we have to do both. I mean, we have to study the Earth because we are now using the Earth up is a way to look at it. I mean, the global warming is going to force us to face our own problems because it's not going to go away. It's only going to get worse. The oceans are going to rise. People are, and they are rising. People are going to be underwater. You can't deny that when it's staring you in the face.
I sometimes wonder if that's just part of the evolutionary control of our species, the human species, that have gotten out of hand.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up because the book I'm reading now is called A World Without Us by Alan Weisman, and he's going to be a guest on our radio show. And it talks about what the Earth would look like if people were no longer there.
What does he say?
And he talks about how quickly the Earth would revert to its natural form, how the bridges and the buildings and the skyscrapers would all decay, and how the species would change, and the different kinds of plants and animals that would take over, why this all happens and how it all happens. And he gives a time scale on the matter of tens, hundreds, thousands, millions of years. It's absolutely fascinating. And he's such a good writer, and he talks about, you know, how the Earth could go on without us, and how the radioactive, you know, we have these nuclear power plants, they'd all decay and start melting down. And he uses Chernobyl as an example. There are species of birds that are highly radioactive that are doing just fine. You know, live right there at Chernobyl. Chernobyl is a spot no one's allowed to come near, but animals still are living there. So it's unpredictable.
Well, Ira Flatow, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And although you may have just done it, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Well, I'm going to say that book, The World Without Us. And I recommend everybody to, it's by Alan Weisman, it's just out. It's a great book that it makes you think, it's well written, and it gives you a whole new perspective. And I don't think you'll look at the world the same way again.
Well, Ira Flatow, thanks for being with us on Radio Curious.
You're welcome.
Ira Flatow is the author of Present at the Future, From Evolution to Nanotechnology, Candid and Controversial Conversations on Science and Nature. He is also the host of National Public Radio's Science Friday. The book that Ira Flatow recommends is The World Without Us by Alan Weisman. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.